You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Today we return to the world of the Fae in the company of the Fairy Whisperer herself, Claire Casely. Claire's show explores the multi-sensory pathways into the other worlds of the fairy and other such supernatural beings, and we discuss her paranormal journey. From a family connection to one of my very favourite British ghost stories, to haunted cottages, pixies, gnomes and the fae join the conversation. A massive thank you to Claire for joining me on this week's episode. But as always, before we get there, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. A big thank you to my two latest patrons, Sean and Samantha. Thank you for joining the gang, and to each and every one of my patrons. Thank you for your continued support. It means the world. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And don't forget, you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, settle back as I speak with Claire about a whole plethora of high strangeness. On this episode, we return to the realm of the Fae in the company of the Fairy Whisperer, Claire Casely. An author, artist, podcast host, Claire resides in the magical area of Dartmoor and has sought to engage people into the world of the Fae. With a wealth of unusual experiences, some people just seem to be a magnet to strange events. Claire, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters for hopefully your first of many appearances in the future.
Hello, Paul. Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Whenever I delve into this subject, it's kind of a running joke for long-regular members of my audience. Because the first time I broached the subject of the Fae on the show, 2 weeks later, I ended up in hospital with a Victorian illness, and therefore everybody thought I'd been disrespectful to the Fae. So if there's one thing I've learnt, Claire, over the years, is that I shall always treat these subjects with the respect, regardless. I have people who I've got to know in this field, other people who do podcasts, who are absolutely terrified of this subject, Claire.
Okay, yeah.
But I think we're both old hands. Well, not particularly old, as we're both the same age. We're of a similar vintage.
Yes.
So I think as long as we treat the subject with the dignity and respect it deserves, I think we're both all right. So, yeah. As I said in the introduction, Claire, some people have strange lives in regards to feeling like they don't fit in, or they're a little bit out of time, or some people in this modern era perhaps think that they would be more connected to what we would consider Wiccans or pagans these days, as they have always sort of had a connection with the countryside and the areas of natural beauty that we're very fortunate to have on our doorsteps for a lot of us in the UK. For you, Claire, what was it that brought you into the strange? For some people, it's they lived in a haunted house, they had a relative who would terrify them on an evening with ghost stories, or they were corrupted by an eager relative giving them a spooky book for Christmas. So what's your excuse to be here today, Claire?
Okay, so it was having a sense of the other world from a young age, and also being corrupted by my grandfather, who encouraged my interest in the paranormal. And we were just talking, weren't we, about the hairy hand story, which
yes
was a family story. And I loved when we went to visit my grandfather. This is my paternal grandfather. I'd always want him to tell me this story. And I just found it fascinating. And he had some ghost stories as well from his childhood. growing up in Princetown, and he bought me the Usborne books about UFOs, about ghosts and witches and monsters, and I just absolutely loved them. My parents didn't really understand my interest in all things strange. But I've always loved it, and I've always found it fascinating, and that, I don't know, it's almost like coming home.
Mm.
Yeah, coming home with the subject. It's just gives me that sense of, yes, there's more than the mundane in this world.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I think, Claire, as we've tempted our listeners with this mutual love of a particular story, I am insanely jealous that you happen to be related to people involved in it, I have to say. So for anybody who's unaware, because it's one of those stories, Claire, I know it so well because it was one of the first ghost stories that ever actually frightened me as a child, that I'm still amazed that anybody who claims to love the supernatural or ghosts doesn't know this story, because well, it's not a story, it's a selection of experiences, which is probably one of the UK's strangest alleged ghosts.
Yes, and as I said, I feel connection with it because of the family connection through my great grandfather Samuel Charles Wesley Casely, good old Methodist name. And he moved my grandfather and his wife and other son from the Isle of Wight in 1920, because my grandfather was great-grandfather Sam. He was a prison nurse, and he'd got a job at HMP Dartmoor as a pharmacist.
Mm.
So I don't know whether that was a step up in those days. And so they lived in prison accommodation, which is now gone, but I've been up to Princetown and researched where they used to live. He was working, this was 1921 when this incident happened. He worked alongside Dr. Ernest Hasler Helby, who was involved in this hairy hand story, and it happened in 1921. Dr. Helby had gone to Tavistock. He'd been taking part of a coroner's examination report on a farmer that had had an accident with his tractor, a fatal accident. Yeah. So he was on the way back from there, and he was giving a lift in his sidecar to the daughters of the deputy prison governor. So there's certain facts in the story, as it's been repeated over the years, that have been mistold.
Yes.
So some of the stories say it was Dr. Helby's daughters. It wasn't. It was the daughters of the deputy prison governor.
Mm-hmm.
And they were aged 12 and 14 at the time. They were called Violet and Essex.
Mm-hmm.
So they were part of the aristocracy, really.
Mm.
So he was heading along I've forgotten the number of the road, but it's a B road that goes down into Postbridge. And it's very long, steep, and the road has got a bit of a steep camber to it on one side.
Mm-hmm.
It goes down into a ditch. The road gradually goes downhill into Postbridge. And still to this day, some people decide to break the speed limit driving along this road. It's just one of those roads, I think. So he was driving back on his motorcycle, these two girls in the sidecar. He lost control of the motorcycle and came off the road, hit the wall, and was killed. So I decided to research this story and looked at the British newspaper archive to find out what actually happened. And the first newspaper report said that he had sustained a fracture to the skull, and that the front axle of the bike had broken. So that's what they discerned was the cause of the accident. And it said that The evidence of the girls was thrown out because of their state of mind. So come back to my great grandfather then. The family story is that my great grandfather Samuel was called out to the scene of the accident and pronounced Dr. Helby dead at the scene. My grandfather said that the story that the girls told was that they had seen two hairy hands grab the handles of the motorcycle, the handlebars, and steer the motorcycle off the road. They were thrown out of the sidecar onto the bank and survived with bruises and shock. So, and they'd gone into Postbridge to get help. So that was the story that wasn't in the newspaper, obviously. That wouldn't be printed in the newspaper. So this was in March. Within a few months, about 6 months later, towards Halloween, coincidentally.
Yes.
Halloween. The story appeared in the Mirror newspaper, and by that time they were talking about invisible hands. There wasn't any mention of hairy hands, it was invisible hands. So the story had gradually grown and been embellished since the original accident, but there's no record of what the girls said, only my grandfather saying that this is what they'd said, that they'd seen these hairy hands. So then about the same time, I think it was a few months later, no, later in that summer, so in the October report, they were talking about another motorcyclist who had been going along the road, and he'd been steered off the road by a pair of muscular hairy hands. So this was a second story that came about that then led to the story escalating and being embellished even more. So it's really, it's fascinating. There are loads over the years, there are loads of different theories about what the hands could be. Could they be some kind of prehistoric remnant of, you know, from the people that used to live in that area? Some kind of elemental? Could it be the hands of someone that was killed at the nearby powder mills, which was a gunpowder making factory? There was a story that it could be the hands of somebody that was blown up, you know, in one of the accidents that happened there when with the gunpowder. So then a few years later, Theo Brown, who was a local folklorist and had one of her books growing up called Devon Ghosts, which is an absolutely brilliant record of local folklore. She was staying in a caravan with her mother near Powder Mills, and her mother says that she woke up in the night and saw her hand crawling up the outside of the caravan. And she made the sign of a cross, of the cross, and the hand disappeared. So it seems to be that there's quite a few stories about this particular haunting. And to this day, apparently, people have had experiences where they felt their vehicle being pulled off the road. But it was the story that really lighted my interest in, you know, in ghost stories in all areas of the paranormal, really.
It's certainly one of the, as I said to you before we started our interview proper, Claire, it's a story that stuck with me for probably 40 years, because I remember reading about it whilst on holiday in Wales in a caravan, and I did not get a wink of sleep that night, because all I kept thinking was that there was some, you'd hear strange noises outside, and when you ate, you automatically assume that it can't possibly be somebody coming back to their caravan after having a few shandies, Claire. It must be a pair of disembodied hands trying to get me. It's a story. I've always loved this particular story. I just think it's just a very odd spooky story as well, I think.
It is. And I was interested with, you know, all these stories that are coming out now about the Sasquatch, the dog men.
Mm.
And it makes you think, or maybe it could be connected to something like that. You know, it's, really fascinating.
It is. It's always made me scratch my head because it's only sort of recently I've fully embraced my love of all weird things since I've started doing this show, Claire. But obviously I've always had an interest, and I was always that weird person who, when they met strangers on a social engagement, Claire would push the conversation towards ghosts, because I always like to hear people's ghost stories.
Yes.
Because I think a lot of people have them, and they've got to be in the right company to unbridle themselves of this secret often. So I'm always leading people astray into the paranormal. And I've heard it from three different people who live in South Yorkshire. None of them know each other. And here in South Yorkshire, obviously, we have the M1 cuts its way through us on its way up to Leeds.
Yeah.
And outside of Sheffield, there is a viaduct known as Tinsley Viaduct, which runs parallel to the Meadow Hall shopping complex. And the first of the people who sort of opened up about this was probably, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago. And it was my partner's mother at that time who would never drive over that particular bridge, because whenever she was on it, she always felt like somebody was grabbing hold of the car wheel and trying to drive her into the hard shoulder side. So if she was in the fast lane, it wanted her to go all the way across traffic. And she hated it. She would go miles out of her way, Claire, to avoid travelling that stretch of road.
Wow.
Even to the point it would add 20, 30 minutes to her journey. She would rather do that than do it. And since then, I've spoken to two other people, one a man and another lady, and they have both had the same feeling of fighting for control of the wheel as they travel over this viaduct next to Meadow Hall. Now, I'm not sure where this has come from or what it does. Nobody says they see anything, but they all say it really feels like somebody's trying to pull the wheel and you've got to fight, hold it. Like the chap I spoke to said he was holding onto the wheel so much his knuckles were turning white.
Wow.
Because he said it was such an effort just to hold the wheel straight. And it literally, he probably travelled like this for 100, 200 yards, and then all of a sudden it just lifted. And his hands just relaxed immediately.
Mm.
And this was sort of 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
This was the other thing. All the incidents had occurred in the daytime.
Yeah, well, you know, the story of the hairy hands, the Dr. Helby's accident, that was in the daytime. Just an ordinary spring day.
Yes.
And I've just recently, actually, because I wanted to look a bit into the background of the story and see if there are any reports of accidents happening on that road prior to 1921.
Mm.
And there is, actually. I've just recently found in the newspaper archive, there's a few strange accidents that happened around that road. But one in particular was very unusual, where a young boy was unfortunately killed when he was riding a pony and trap.
Mm.
And for some reason, his horse decided to, you know, so not a steering wheel, but a horse decided to go veer off into a different direction, which resulted in him being pinned against the hedge.
Oh.
So, yeah, he was crushed. A tragic accident. But so it makes you wonder whether, you know, this seems to be some sort of strange accident hotspot. And there are reasons given by locals saying, well, the road is very, pothole-y, it's not very, very well surfaced, all those kinds of things. But still, these seem to be quite irregular accidents in this area.
Yeah, I think often it's easy to sort of say, oh, well, these people are tourists, or they're not known to the area. But as far as I'm aware, because obviously I've looked at that, because when you start to see a strange story in a particular stretch of road, Claire, you begin to think, as you say, why do so many people have so many accidents on a particular stretch of road? And for that particular area, at that particular time when this story starts, these would all be local people. They would probably travel up and down that road more than anybody would do. They would know it like the back of their hand. So the excuse that, oh, well, people just didn't take care on it, I find a bit hard. And if people are losing control of horses, never mind motorcycles or cars, then that seems to be, well, it seems to affect all modes of transport, which would then suggest that there's something more to this than just coincidence.
Yeah. And alongside that road, there's Belva Tor, and there's loads of prehistoric settlements there. There's lots of archaeology, and you can't really see it now. I mean, at that time, you would have been able to see all of that because the forestry wasn't there. So it would have been just open moorland. Now, when you go along that road towards Postbridge, it's just Belva Forest, so you can't really see any of the ancient settlements. It does make me wonder whether it's something to do with the energetics of that landscape. I do feel that certain places have these kinds of different feelings to them, different energies, especially Dartmoor. There are some really, there are some powerful hotspots on Dartmoor because of these antiquities, like Merivale, Stone Rose, the standing stones there. And there's also a fault that goes through Dartmoor, and it's called the Sticklepath Fault, that goes through the top of Dartmoor near Okehampton at a place called Sticklepath. It starts up on the North Devon coast, actually, near Hartland sort of area. And then it goes all the way down through the sort of right-hand side of Dartmoor, if you're looking at the map. Past Chagford, down through Lustley Cleeve, and then out at Torbay. And it's strange that in Lustley Cleeve and around Chagford, there's quite a few stories of pixies, and there's a few time slip experiences that people have reported as well over the years.
Is it also as well, because of this incident that started this particular case, Claire? I love a motorised ghost. If, say, some people see a car or a plane or something. And obviously this accident that became the sort of birth of this legend that saw it explode from the locality was a motorcycle and a sidecar. Has there been any reports of people seeing anything like that or whatever? Because obviously one of the most famous motorcycle based ghosts I can think isn't too far away, which is obviously the legendary Lawrence of Arabia. His tragic death, tragic in the fact that he took evasive action to save the life of two boys that ran into the road, and he unfortunately lost his life on his beloved Brough motorcycle, which he strangely called George. He had seven bikes and they were all called George 1 to 7. Which is one of those strange things. And so people near his beautiful home that he'd bought to retire to have often heard the roar of his engine on those lonely roads where he lost his life. So it's things like that. And obviously Lawrence is a sort of legendary figure in British military history in the last 100 years as well, Claire. So it's things like that. I always get my paranormal juices flowing.
Yeah, I don't know if there's I don't know of sightings of vehicles. I do know about Lawrence because I used to work in Dorchester back at the beginning of, was it about 2001, 2002 sort of time. I was working as a teacher in one of the schools there in my old life before I got into fairies. And I used to drive around exploring the lanes in the evenings, and I remember just by chance finding his memorial one evening and just being absolutely blown away by it, and just like, oh wow, that's T. Lawrence, wow. only knew about him because of the film Lawrence of Arabia. Yes. And thought, oh wow, a legendary figure. And it's only through seeing that that I read up about him and learnt about his accident and the ghost and,
mm-hmm.
and all of that. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm hopefully going to try it because I'm on the South Coast next month. I'm visiting friends in Bournemouth. And so I've got two things I want to do. I want to go to Clouds Hill, which is obviously Lawrence's home.
Yeah.
And I'm finally going to visit the grave of Mary Shelley. So I'm, you know, this is the age I've got to, Claire, now. When most people go away, they look for a, you know, a nice restaurant, and I'm just looking for graves and haunted houses.
Me too. I'm very similar.
It's a great way to be, I find.
I think so, yeah. I know. I'm sort of like, I tend to look at the map and think, yeah. Oh, there was a fairy sighting near there. Oh, there's an Airbnb.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, one of the things now, wherever I go, because I'm in, ironically, it was my love of Dracula that got me to join the English Heritage, because I wanted to go to Whitby Abbey for the first time, and it was closed to the public unless you paid £30 to watch a Viking reenactment.
Right.
And there was a lady there selling memberships to the English Heritage and said, well, if you sign up, you can pay every month and it's free in today. So I thought, wow. Right, we'll do that. And so now, it's one of the other things, I now go, right, okay, what English Heritage sites can I get into around there as well now? But I find that's much better than wasting my afternoons drinking all afternoon in a variety of pubs, I think.
Yes. Well, one of the most famous English Heritage places near me, famous for ghosts, is Bury Pomeroy. Have you heard of Bury Pomeroy?
I have indeed. I've got the National Trust ghost book. The English Heritage ghost book, sorry.
Well, right.
I've probably got both, Claire. I've got more books than I can shake a stick at these days.
Okay, yes.
And I know that one's mentioned in one of them, so I would imagine it's the Heritage one.
Yes, yeah. So and there's actually a pixie sighting associated with Bury Pomeroy as well. Yeah. So I got my English Heritage and I said to my kids, we've been to Bury Pomeroy a few times, but I think it was last year. I said, oh, let's go to Bury Pomeroy. But my ulterior motive was because I wanted to just go down into the woods behind Bury Pomeroy. Yes. And find where this pixie sighting attachment.
Two birds with one stone, Claire.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, as you say there, it was the supernatural that sort of opened your mind into the realms of the other, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I know your early life, you began to have a lot of strange experiences. But I'm very interested in this because I've heard this from other people as well who have experiences with ghosts or spirits or living in a haunted house as a young child or a teenager, Claire, and then they have a family situation, be it a separation or a divorce or a death, that for some reason, whether it's the emotions that the person is going through or their focus is completely set on something else or there's too much change for them to kind of see the wood from the trees, their experiences stop for a period. That seems to have happened to you when you were growing up, because obviously I believe your parents separated when you were around 10. So
yes.
Do you buy into that kind of philosophy, Claire? Do you think it's a situation that the emotional state you are in can close you off from things for a while?
Yes, definitely. Because I was just very open as a child, and I was lucky enough to have my grandmother who lived just literally two doors up from me. So I spent a lot of time in my garden and in her garden growing up. She was a very creative person. That's where my artistic side comes from, and love of nature. She helped to encourage that. And she passed away when I was 5, which was a huge shock. That was it was just very unexpected. Mm-hmm. She was like a second mother to me, really.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that kind of started to change things for me. But really, it was when I started school, because until then, I'd had a very sort of free, open kind of childhood where I was just doing what I wanted. I didn't realise I was different in any way.
Yeah.
then I went to school and I thought, oh, I see things differently than most of these people are surrounded by. Yes. Actually, I don't like this very much. Yeah. So I think it was about survival. I still continued to, I mean, I always used to tell my friends ghost stories and scare them. They loved that. That was one of the things that I really enjoyed doing. Yes. At school, you know, with my other friends that were a bit sort of more different like me, and my art and things, love that. But it wasn't until I left school and went to do my A levels when I started to, I suppose, open up a bit more to who I was, and that these experiences were something that I wanted to reconnect with, not in a kind of a conscious way, but I think just maybe I'd had some kind of defense mechanism in place while I was at survival tactics while I was at school. And then leaving school, I began to connect with this other world, this other realm again. Yeah. And I went, one of the first things I experienced was staying in a cottage that belonged to some friends of my father. And we went to stay there just for a night in Somerset. And it was a thatched cottage, very old, surrounded by farmland. It was down a very long track.
Oh, yeah.
So there weren't any houses nearby. There wasn't any street lighting around. It was just beautiful. It had a beautiful feeling to it. It just felt very old and full of history and, I suppose, other dimensions.
Yes. Yeah.
Just have that sense about it.
Mm.
So me and my sister were sharing a bedroom, and my sister went to sleep. I remember dropping off, but then woke up for some reason, and it was pitch black in the room. And at the end of my bed, towards where the door was, the door into the room, there was a green light, and it was just hovering above the floor. It was a small green light. To me, it looked kind of like an oblong shape on its end.
Yeah.
And I was just staring at it, and I couldn't work it out because there was no light coming in through the curtains. There wasn't anything electrical in the room. I mean, this was about 1991, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
1990, maybe. About 17 or 18. So there wasn't anything, you know, there wasn't any smartphones in those days or anything that could produce a light like that in the room. It didn't feel threatening or scary. It wasn't making any noise. It was just hovering. And I was looking at it and I just couldn't work it out. It's like my brain couldn't work out what it was and make sense of it. So because it wasn't going away, and I was too afraid to get out of bed and put the light on, because that would have meant having to walk past it because the light switch was beside the door as he came into the room.
Yes.
I decided just to hide under the duvet. My sister was fast asleep. I tried to wake her, just sort of tapping her, but she was absolutely out cold. You know, when people just go to sleep and they're just so soundly asleep.
Yes.
So I just hid under the duvet. I was really hot, but somehow I managed to get to sleep. And yeah, and I checked the room in the morning, and there's absolutely nothing that could have been producing this green light. So it's only now I look back and think, was that some kind of elemental fairy connected with the landscape? Because it was just farmland all the way around the cottage.
Mm.
So yeah.
Yeah, well, the land's always been there, and just because somebody's thrown a cottage on it doesn't mean that they're moving anywhere, Claire, often.
No.
And I think if you're in a thatch cottage at the end of a lonely lane, it's amazing how close you can be to civilization, and yet when you're in such a venue as that, and I've stopped in places all around the UK where you're 30 minutes drive away from seeing more than three houses in 5 minutes. But it is strange how it seems to be quite otherworldly that you can perhaps hear the hum of a distant road, or you'll be able to see lights from a town or something like that, or a faraway train line or something. And yet you feel disconnected from the modern world.
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a few cottage stories, actually.
Yes.
So I used to love, well, I still love old cottages, but I had a dream of living in one. And so when I became a single parent in about 2010, I decided that I was going to rent a cottage.
Mm.
I'd lived in an old cottage before and hadn't had any problems. But it was really strange, Paul. I don't know how to describe it. I became obsessed with this cottage.
Yeah.
It was like an obsession because I saw it advertised and I drive past it at least like two or three times a week, like look in the windows, be like, oh, I really want to live here. It really felt like it was drawing me in. And I mean, I wasn't in a great place at that time either. I don't know whether that's got something to do with it, because I'd just gone through this breakup and I was wanting to start a new life with my kids as well. So I managed to rent this cottage. I remember going and showing my mum around it, and my mum's quite sensitive, I think, to otherworldly things, but she's not as open-minded as me about paranormal. After moving in, she said to me, and I'd been there a while, she said to me one day, Claire, she said, I must admit that when I came and looked around with you, she said, do you remember I went out to the garden? And I said, oh yeah, I remember you disappeared out there. She said, I went out there and I cried.
Oh.
She said, because, yeah, she said, I just felt so this overpowering sadness. Yeah. And I thought, I wish you told me that at the time.
Yeah, could you, when I told you I was signing the contract, do you think you could have mentioned that, please?
Yeah. So anyway, moved in and nothing went right from the start. Things were going wrong with one of the first things that happened was my washing machine flooded the kitchen.
Oh.
It was a new washing machine, and so it flooded the kitchen. I used to be sitting in my sitting room, and there's a doorway through to the kitchen. There wasn't a door, it was just an open doorway. Always felt like I was being watched. I had problems with the electric, so the phone line needed updating. I had problems with so many little things while we were there. It just didn't feel like we were welcome.
Yeah.
That's the feeling. I felt like this place doesn't like me for some reason. Mm. Then the central heating stopped working. It was oil-fired central heating.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Which is, so horrendously expensive.
Yes.
Everybody's had that. Have you had oil-fired before?
No, but I know a couple. I've got a friend who owns a farm, and they're just enough off the track of civilization, Claire, that they're not even connected to the water main, so they've got to have a massive slurry bin buried under their garden. It's the size of a submarine.
Right. Oh gosh.
Which is great if you visit them when it's being emptied. It's fabulous.
Yeah. Oof, yeah.
You've never smelled anything like that in your life.
Oh my god. So then the central heating stopped working. and it was the winter, and we just had a log burner. It's not funny, but it's just like looking back, it's just like, oh my God.
Well, you've got to laugh, Claire, otherwise you'd cry.
Yeah, that's right. So
your tears would freeze on your face. I don't want that.
It's me and the kids. I was stoking up this log burner every night. I had electric heaters. Anyway, my kids, and also my energy. My energy was getting really drained in this place. I was literally flopping into bed in the afternoon. And I mean, I have sort of, I had to look after my energy anyway. I have like chronic fatigue that I manage, but that place seemed to be sucking the life out of me because I just feel so drained all the time.
Yeah.
And anyway, my kids went to stay with their dad for that Christmas. I was there on my own, which I wasn't really looking forward to, but I thought, oh, I'm just gonna make the best of it. And I decided, because it was so cold, I decided to sleep in my son's room. And I had about like 3 duvets on top of me and jumpers.
Yes.
Trying to keep warm.
As many layers as possible.
As many layers as possible. I thought, oh, great. I just got comfortable. I was leaving the light on because the other thing was, before I go into this next bit, I used to have my bedroom in the attic. There's an attic room. And my daughter had it first. She was having bad dreams up there. So I moved her downstairs to my bedroom. I went up there. I stayed up there only a couple of weeks. I couldn't sleep up there. I just felt watched all the time. So I moved downstairs. I moved the kids into one room together.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I was in bed. And about to sort of try and get to sleep. And then I heard all of a sudden, it's really loud footsteps in the hallway. Because it was floorboards, it's wooden floor. Just stomping, you know, bang, 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 really loud. Frightened the life out of me. And I knew that, I mean, this is a really old cottage, very thick walls. There's like a little old lady that lived next to me in the next cottage along, and a family the other side. Never heard them because the walls are so thick.
Yeah.
You just couldn't hear your neighbours there. And this was definitely directly outside the bedroom. So then I immediately thought, I cannot stay here tonight. You know, I have to. So I phoned my mum. I said, oh, can I come and stay with you? And this was around midnight that this happened. yeah, around the classic time.
Yes, yes.
I didn't even know if I was going to get out of the bedroom because I was afraid what was on the landing. But I thought, I've just got to do it. So I just quickly grabbed a couple of things and left the house. And again, it was in a little village in the countryside. There's no street lights outside. So as soon as I put the house lights out, it was pitch black and I couldn't find my car. I couldn't even see my car.
Wow.
So I just had this had this experience and I was feeling around in the pitch black. So I didn't, you know, pick up a torch before I left, trying to feel where my car was. Yeah. So anyway, I drove to my mum's and spent a few nights with her. And then I managed to end the contract, the rental agreement, early because of all the problems. I said, I can't stay here. I didn't say there's ghosts. I just said...
Well, the appliances are broken and it's freezing.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, so that ended my love affair with cottages.
Well, as the old saying goes, Claire, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
I suppose it's interesting as well, and I doubt they'd probably have even been happy to furnish you with this information, but Was there a regular turnover of tenants in this particular property, or as you say, was it the fact that the house just didn't seem to like you, or whatever was in this house didn't like you and your children being there?
I don't know. I don't know the history of, you know, who had been there before, or I wasn't privy to that information, to be honest. So all I do know was that it's an old mill cottage, and under the kitchen, which was an extension, there was the old mill leat.
So there was
running water.
Underneath
the kitchen. So wow. I didn't know at the time, but since that time, obviously I found out that running water can be connected to psychic phenomena.
Yes.
And it was during living in that house, actually, that I became really fascinated, even more fascinated with the paranormal, obviously because of the experiences I was having. And I started watching paranormal shows.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to understand what was happening for me. You know, I was trying to reach for something that was like to explain what was going on.
Mm.
So, you know, I got into like Most Haunted and Ghost Adventures, all those guys.
So often, Claire, I think when you have a passion or a love of these particular subjects, you tend to gravitate towards specific areas of the country.
Yeah.
Now, Dartmoor. Goodness me. What doesn't happen in Dartmoor, it would seem? Because I think, obviously, a lot of my listeners are based outside of the United Kingdom. Most people will probably be aware of Dartmoor, even though it's not technically named as such in the book. It's obviously the setting for Hound of the Baskervilles.
Yes. Yeah.
And Conan Doyle, obviously a man who became fully embroiled in the world of spiritualism after his writing career had finished in regards to Holmes. It's surprising that certain locations seem to be just full of strange things, because obviously Dartmoor has legends of witches and ghosts and hellhounds and shooks and strange cat-like creatures. And then obviously you've got the arguments about what they even call the little people there, because obviously, is it the same in Dartmoor? Because obviously a lot of Dartmoor it sort of straddles a smidgen of Cornwall and Devon. Is it one of those places? Because I know Cornwall, it depends who you speak to when you talk about the little people, because they've got I think they've got three distinct types in Cornwall. They've got the knockers, which everybody seems to know about, and then obviously you've got your normal pisky or pesky. Or pixie, depending, like I said, once again, it depends who you ask. Or pixies, even. There seems to be so many variations of it. And then you've also got the ones that nobody wants to really talk about, which is it the Spriggans?
The Spriggans,
Who are supposed to be nasty, nasty little people, whereas the others are quite just mischievous, if anything. Is it the same in Dartmoor, that you have these differing members of the little people populations?
No. So the old stories talk about the pixies, and in Devon, the pixies is a generalised term to cover all fairies.
Yeah.
However, some of the stories talk about the pixies and the fairies being two distinct races. My experience of pixies is as a specific type of fairy. Yeah, my interactions with them and an understanding of them is of, you know, specific looking type of fairy. Growing up, I didn't really connect with the images of fairies that I saw in books. So therefore, my sort of understanding of the other world and my sense of nature and what, you know, the beings that were in nature didn't really feel aligned with the pretty sort of Victorian fairies that I saw in books.
Yes.
My first sighting of a fairy was, you know, actual little being, was when I was at university in Swansea. and I had a rubber plant in my room beside my bed. I went out for a night out, student night out, partying. I had taken some mind-altering substances, and came home not feeling great at all.
Mm.
And I woke up in the night to have a drink of water, and I looked over to my rubber plant, and there was a little person sat in the rubber plant that I, at the time, thought, well, that's an elf. I think all these, some of these terms, some people are very specific about different types of fairies, but, you know, sometimes in folklore, pixies are called elves, or they're called goblins, or they're, you know, so I didn't really necessarily know about the pixies at that time. So I only knew about elves, and that's what came to me.
Yeah.
When I saw this little being sat in the plant. And it was just a very, very brief sighting of him. It was a male, I would say about 6 inches high, sat in my plant, looking across at me, very dark, sparkly eyes. He just looked curious that I could see him. And that's the sense I've got from other, you know, connecting with these beings, is yeah. that they feel kind of surprised that we can see them sometimes, or intrigued. He might have been a bit concerned about how I was. So I was feeling horrible.
Yeah.
And because of the way I was feeling, you know, I didn't, and because I'd never experienced seeing anything like that before, I just kind of, you know, you'd sort of think, well, why didn't you get out of bed and put the light? I just wasn't in the state of mind to get out of bed, put the light on, inspect the plant, or, you know, communicate, try and communicate with it or anything. I just literally wanted to go to sleep. So it was like, oh, I'll deal with that later. But it's only looking back, it sort of feels like a bit of an initiatory kind of experience, because after that, when I got home from university, I started drawing fairies a lot. All these fairies drawings were coming out of me. And I kept getting drawn back to drawing fairies and having, you know, reading about them over the years. And then it wasn't till about 2013, I left the corporate world. So I'd worked as a teacher, then I'd gone into the corporate world working as an IT trainer, and I'm very creative. So it wasn't really, it didn't really suit me at all. And I ended up being really burnt out. So I ended up leaving the job I was in, which is a very good job. And the way that I got myself well was to go back to doing my artwork and walking in nature and learning some healing practices. So it's from that point I took a different path, and that's when I began to connect with the fairies. And I took a job, it was not a job, it's a voluntary position working for a local house that is near Exeter. And they wanted volunteers just to help around the gardens. So I went and I said, actually, I'd just like to paint the gardens and paint the interior of the house. This is a really old house and it's dilapidated. And they've been working for years to try and get some funding to do it up. And it's very haunted.
Ooh.
And as I learnt through spending lots of time there in the gardens, it's full of fairies. I found my time there really healing. And I'd see little faces in the trees. I took a couple of interesting photos, actually. There's one where there's a huge green orb by these trees, which I felt were just really full of fairies. And there's another image I took of what looks like this magenta face that's caught in the light on one of these trees. It looks like a gnome, actually. Yeah, and then, I mean, the inside of the house is really spooky. It's all different ages.
Yeah.
There's part of it that goes back, oh, I think it's Tudor or 15th, maybe 15th century. There's all different parts of it. And then there's some 17th century parts. And there's one area that I used to spend time in this house on my own while I was there. For some reason, I didn't mind. I used to sit in the house and I used to draw the, they've got some beautiful old ceilings. And but I used to hear things while I was there. I didn't have any sort of visual sightings, but I heard a woman coughing when I was there one day. Just had a sense that there were spirits around me. And actually, since in the last couple of years, I've heard a filmmaker talking about, because they rent the house out as a film location, talking about filming there and how all the crew had experiences there, but they all felt that they were welcome.
Yeah.
And that's what I felt, that these spirits were very welcoming. There was only one grumpy spirit I came across in one of the rooms that I went into, with this big Tudor sort of fireplace, and there was a hole in the ceiling, and I was looking up through the hole in the ceiling. There was this huge bang, like somebody had slammed a door, and I thought, oh, I'm not welcome in here.
Stop looking up there. Yeah, stop it.
Yeah. But to be honest, Paul, that was, I know it sounds strange, you know, hanging out in a haunted house and these gardens that were very otherworldly as well, but really helped me get onto a new track being there. I've got a real soft spot for this place. I think some places can be really healing.
Absolutely. It was probably one of those situations, I think, sometimes in our lives, Claire, that we often find ourselves in locations that we don't realise we need to be there until we leave.
Yeah. That's right.
I suppose one of the questions somebody would say, Claire, is what is the difference between a pixie and a fairy then? Why do some people call them? Because it often, as you say, makes me chuckle, as you mentioned earlier, that people sometimes just label everything as fairies.
Yeah.
And yet you only have to go around the British Isles and Ireland to realise that every specific area has very different sort of interpretations and names for them, and they behave very differently. And I think these days more people are sort of, we're kind of cutting off all this sort of cultural cleanliness of the fairy myth into these kind of shimmery, bright, happy things that flutter about humans being all happy and joyful. And we're kind of returning to some of these, well, they are very nice, but don't cross them because it'll be the last thing you do.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I've never had any difficult encounters with fairies. I think they're mischievous. I know some people have, and I'm not discounting them, but I'm just talking about my experience. So fairy as a subject is like a, for me, that's the term that covers all fairies, but then within that family, within that umbrella term, there are all these different types of fairy. So pixies are a type of fairy, and so they are believed to be quite mischievous. In the old days, they'd help people.
Yep.
So they'd, there are stories of pixies helping farmers with threshing corn, or with maids helping them to milk cows or clean houses. They'd help housemaids clean the homes, all those kinds of things. And people would leave out tokens of gratitude for them, which would usually be like a bowl of milk or a bowl of water.
Yes.
And then sometimes the pixies would drop in a silver coin into the water, or a gold ring.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a give and take relationship that people had. But I think the negative things come in when the church gets involved with the folklore. So I think this old relationship that people had with nature spirits, which probably goes back thousands of years and which is still retained in some cultures, such as the Native American people and their belief system, as soon as the church got involved in trying to deter people from believing in these spirits and, paying them attention, because the church wanted people to come in through their doors, they started to proliferate, this propaganda that made fairies out to be demons or to be evil, and you mustn't get involved with them because this will happen, or if you gossip, then this will happen or that will happen to you. So there's all a fearfulness brought into the tradition. I'm not saying that there aren't any bad, or not bad fairies, but people that have had very dark experiences with fairies. I know that those happen. But also, I haven't experienced that, and I've only had good experiences with them. I received a lot of gifts that I feel have come through from fairies whenever I've, questioned, as we quite often do with this kind of work. I certainly do think, why am I doing this again?
Yes.
Surely I should be sitting having a normal, ordinary job somewhere. And
who wants that, Claire?
Yeah, I know. And then whatever it is, whatever doubt comes up, something comes along, and then someone or like a friend will give me a lovely book to do with fairies. They'll say, oh, Claire, I've had this book for a few years. A friend recently gave me a dictionary I'd wanted for many years by a well-known author and folklorist whose name I've forgotten at the moment. And I was like, wow, that is amazing. That book's really hard to get hold of. And that kind of thing will happen. And it'd be like, oh, yeah. And I'm just talking about things happening around my podcast, actually. This has just happened in the last few days. I've had a whole series of experiences where I felt that these are signs or gifts from the Fae.
Yeah.
So I've just released, I'm releasing an episode this week, which is called The Goblin Market, where I speak to a guest about her experiences of seeing a goblin market on her windowsill as a child. And also she had the ability to find four-leaf clovers really regularly. So she has a big jar of them. And I said to her, I've never found a four-leaf clover in my life.
Yeah.
And she really kindly said, oh, Claire, she said, I really feel I want to send you one of my four-leaf clovers. I said, oh, that's so kind. Thank you. I was really touched. Then I went for a walk over the weekend. This was on Sunday. And I was walking into this huge field of, I think it was like cabbages.
Yeah.
And a few steps into the field, I looked down. I couldn't believe it. I was just so blown away. There was a six-leaf clover. I'd only been reading earlier that day about four-leaf clovers and that you could get five-leaf clovers. And there I was, a few steps into this field, and there's a six-leaf clover. I was like, oh, my goodness, it's unbelievable. So I brought it home. I told my guest about it. She said, oh, I think that's definitely a sign, Claire.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then last night, I was doing something very mundane. I just put my bins out.
Yes.
On the side of the house. And there were three four-leaf, they're a type of sorrel, wood sorrel.
Yes, which everybody mistakenly keeps. A lot of people call them clovers, and they're not. They're sorrels, no, yes.
They're sorrels. They're sold, I think I was reading online, they're quite often sold as lucky clovers, but it's a wood sorrel. Yeah. Yes. But I've never had them growing in my garden before. And I was just like, wow, that's just amazing. There they are, these three little wood sorrels with four petals all growing near my bins. It was just one of these chains of synchronicities, I suppose, that sometimes happens around these experiences or in connection with the fae that I find happen. I've had a lot of auditory experiences with fairies as well, hearing sounds and yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say, often when I hear people who have had experiences, Claire, with the little people, often they will say they communicate with them, but no words are spoken. It's almost as if, not that they're psychic, but it's almost as if that they're hearing what they're saying, but it's directly into their mind.
Yeah, oh, definitely. That's my experience with especially being led to places, because I've the last few years have been researching pixie places on Dartmoor, because I'm writing a book about these pixie places. So I've been actively going to find these places, and the first time that I went to one of these places was in 2016, actually, and it's a woodland on Dartmoor. It's very ancient wood. As I was walking towards the woodland, I heard giggling, which is associated with fairy experiences. I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
And I heard a voice say, keep walking around the edge of the wood, which I'd never walked that way around the wood before. Mm-hmm. It'd been quite a few years since I'd been there, actually. It must have been about 6 years since I'd been to this wood. Yeah. So it's in quite a remote part of Dartmoor. So I kept walking around the edge of the wood, and the far end of the wood is a standing stone that I didn't know about at the time.
Oh.
Since researched, it's called the Druid Stone.
Right.
Because there's quite a lot of antiquities in that area. So I asked permission to go into the wood, because I'm always respectful about these special places, and I felt it was a no. So I looked around and I saw that there was some rubbish behind the stone. So I picked it up and asked if I could go in again, and I felt that the answer was yes this time. And before I went in, I took a picture of the stone, and there was an oak tree above the stone, sort of leaning over it. And I went into the woods and did some, I had my sketchbook, I did some drawing, I made some notes in my journal while I was there. And then at home, I posted my photos on social media in a little fairy group that I belong to. And one of the people said, oh, there's a little person in your photograph above the stone. And I looked really closely at the photo, and I could see this little shape of this little old man that was picked out in the light and the shade.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked like he was bent over. He had lichen, mossy sort of hair, lichen-y hair, and his clothes were all natural colours, the same colours as the trees. And he was pointing, looked like he was holding a wand, and he was pointing to where I'd picked up this rubbish. So, yeah, so I know there's, you know, the explanation of pareidolia, but for me it's really strange that this little person, I'd been led to this stone, I'd had these auditory signs, if you like, to go to this stone, found the stone, gone into the wood, taken the photo, and it all just linked together. And after that, I did go back to the wood a few times. I went back again the same year around Halloween, which is a really good time to connect with the other world. The veil is thin.
Yeah.
And I was sat in the woods and I heard like chimes, tinkling chimes. It wasn't my phone. My phone was switched off. There's no one else around. I mean, this is quite a remote place. So, yeah, and I've since making this connection with this pixie, I started to have more and more auditory experiences at home as well. Yeah.
Would you say then, Claire, that you seem to have built some kind of relationship with this particular one that seems to have connected with you? Do you think that it was the fact that you were showing the respect to clear away this rubbish and they sort of thought, oh, this human's not bad. Better than the usual ones, certainly better than the person that's left that litter there. This one might be all right. We'll keep an eye on this one.
I think it is definitely about building connections with places, and the beings there will respond as well. So if we're respectful of places and show that we actually care about the natural world, then it's a give and take. It's a reciprocal relationship. Yeah, so I do. I feel like I've made that connection. I wouldn't say it's like a, I wouldn't say like it's a friendship, because I don't feel these beings want to be friends with us, you know.
Yes.
I feel that they want us to have an alliance with the natural world and be respectful of it.
Yep.
So something happened recently where I was talking to a woman who's an artist, a fairy artist, who I hope I'll have a chance to speak to for my podcast. But she had seen, without going into detail about her account, she had seen very similar beings in that place. And they had been angry about the way that people were treating the wood and treating nature in general. So, you know, and this is something I just found out about recently, about 7 years after I'd had my initial experience with this particular being. So pixie.
So, I mean, that's an interesting point, because I think as someone that's been aware of it, I mean, my first experience, and I think anybody who has an introduction to the world of the fairy in the modern era, obviously we all start with Cottingley. Obviously, being a Yorkshireman, it's not too far away from where I am, and I know you've got relatives who live not too far from that anyway, because it's obviously West Yorkshire. Is it, do you think, the uptake or the opening up of people in the modern era to these worlds, to these creatures, Claire, do you think this is because people have started to become more environmentally conscious, and therefore more people are going out and taking notice of the toxicity that's going on in regards to certain areas just being used as land dumping, and people are just fly tipping in places? And it's only sort of the last 20 years that councils and the general public have really started to sort of be proactive in regards to these wonderful places, not just here in the UK, but across the world, where we've got beautiful aspects of nature on our doorstep, and we've started to sort of finally reappreciate them, that perhaps we haven't done for, I don't know, the best part of 500 years.
Yes, and I think 2020 with lockdown was a big part of that as well. I mean, I really feel that through my experience, in, you know, it seemed to sort of, what do you call it, speed up, develop from about 2016.
Yeah.
I felt that my connection with these, you know, the fae, was about this awareness, about developing this awareness, and probably leading up to that sort of culmination point of 2020, when we were all suddenly, we couldn't leave our local areas, and we had to make the best of what we had and connect with our locality. So I'd already started that process with me and my children, taking care of our local environments, making sure that, for example, on our route to school, we'd pick up rubbish that we saw and things like that. But I'd been really fixated on travelling to all these different places locally and not really paid much attention to the local area. So I feel like that time was a similar experience for many people that I've spoken to, where they suddenly realised what was on their doorstep and that their, you know, their local environment was worth taking note of and protecting.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm. And it is, it is, for me, I think that's very interesting as well, because I think it it's made a lot of people more reflective. I always, I'm always reminded of a quote from Tolkien, well, who was in conversation with C.S. Lewis, often arguing about the quality of each other's ethereal beings in their books, in a good natured way. Obviously, there's a very famous C.S. Lewis retort to Tolkien when he told him he was writing Lord of the Rings, which I'll not repeat it, but it includes a couple of offensive words. but Tolkien was always of the opinion that once people began to reconnect with nature, they would begin to experience these creatures or have sightings or communications with them as they used to do when we were solely dependent on the land, where we basically ate what we grew.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's something over the last two or three years, Claire, that I've really thought out about a lot, because it makes a lot of sense, because I think if you look at where the world of the Fae is these days, I mean, as I said to you before we started our chat properly, if you asked me 5 years ago what I knew about the Fae and folklore in general, especially in the British Isles, I would have done the basic cliched versions of things. What I know now bears no resemblance to that. And I think for someone like you, who's been sort of immersed in this world for the best part of a quarter of a century now, can you see the development that people, I imagine as well, with the birth of the internet and social media, that this whole sphere of folklore has really probably not been as popular in the world since 150 years ago, when people weren't all focused on cities and entertainment and flash holidays and things like that. Now we can look around us more and appreciate everything that's on our doorstep, rather than worrying about 2 weeks away in a foreign country.
Yes, I think so. That I think people are yearning for simplicity, and even though there's lots of things about the modern world that, you know, and our technology that is making life, is, you know, is improving life for us in lots of ways, people are yearning for that simplicity. There's all, you know, when you look at the last few years, there's been a growth in books about and courses about rewilding, and people wanting to create a simpler life. There's, you know, a trend with tiny houses and people going to, you know, going on these glamping holidays and all that kind of thing. So I think it is a sign that we're just yearning to get back to our a simpler way of life. And that's what the fairies represent, I feel. I mean, when people see them, on the whole, people that, and in my experience as well, they've shown themselves in this very old-fashioned clothing that probably goes back to pre-industrialization. And for me, that's a symbol. It's like a symbolizing that time. I think they move with the times. They are of a different time and different dimension, but they're aware of where we are in our, they're not stuck in a sort of a old-fashioned, if you like, sort of mindset. I think they're very aware of where we are moving. And whereabouts where we are in our sort of progression and evolution. That's my sense anyway.
Do you think as well, Claire, that it's one of those subjects that once you dip your toe in, it's amazing how quickly you can become immersed in it?
Yeah.
For anybody that's wanting to know more, because obviously I'm aware of so many people that are pushing the boundaries in regards to pulling this subject back in from the fringes, which it had been for a very long time. I think, as I mentioned, the Cottingley case pushed it well away from any serious sort of academic research, people treating the subject seriously, because a lot of people, when they used to talk about this subject, Claire, would have their tongue firmly in their cheek, and that's putting politely. Yeah. And I think when you look at the work that certain academics have done over the last 20 years, once again, in conjunction with the sort of rebirth of folklore in the modern era, being treated as a real subject worthy of collation and analysis and discussion, that this has kind of opened the doors up for people who would never have looked at this subject seriously and can now sort of go for a wander in their local area, and there will probably be something or somewhere close to them where they've got stories attached to them about little people, be they pixies or fairies or boggarts or peskies or the seer, yeah, or whatever. Do you think that's a good thing that we've got this now, that people seem to have a real thirst for this subject as a serious situation?
Yes, I do, because for me, as an experiencer of this, and then through my work as well, meeting other people that have had very real experiences like myself, people need this validation. The subject needs to move up in the, I don't know, it's kind of been the poor cousin of other paranormal topics, alongside ghosts and UFOs. You talk about ghosts and UFOs, people are more likely to sort of perhaps take that topic a little bit more seriously, or even Bigfoot, for example. But fairies have always been the poorer cousin kind of thing of the paranormal topic. And now more people are opening up because of the likes of Joe's wonderful podcast, Modern Fairy Sightings, for example, as well as many other researchers like yourself. People are stepping forward. People that contact me that want to share their stories, most of the people I've spoken to, they want to be on camera. They want to be open and saying, yeah, this is what I've experienced. I don't know if that would have happened 10 years ago. I say to people, you can remain anonymous if you want to, or I don't have to film you if you don't want to appear on the camera. Or no, I feel it's time that, this information needs to be out there kind of thing. And that's coming from a heart-led place, not an ego place. It's not people looking for, glorification or anything. It's because they want to share their story and this experience to help other people, maybe, or just to feel that it's out there in the world and adding to the validation of these experiences.
I have to say, I was taken aback 2 or 3 years ago, Claire. I was doing some research on an upcoming guest, and she was interviewed by a very sort of fae and folklore orientated show, to the point that the host essentially identified as a fairy, with ears and hair and the dress that she was wearing and the jewellery. It was all very fae inspired. That for me, Claire, I'm a very open-minded person. I'm not really bothered what people decide. It's the content of your character that matters to me, not what it says on your shirt.
So I
honestly didn't realize just how popular this subject had become, as you say, because it's been sort of ridiculed for so long. And I think there are many things that people will criticize the internet for, but I think the fact that it's allowed people like ourselves to make relationships with open-minded people who look at subjects that 20, 30 years ago would have been laughed out of the room anywhere. I think it's a wonderfully positive thing, especially when it comes to this particular aspect of the weird, because yes, there are stories of people having frightening experiences, but I think the overriding aspect of this that I always take away when I ever speak about this particular subject is the connection with the world around us. It's almost as if these are fantastical creatures, beings, whatever they are, and they seem, obviously, as many people will talk about being fairy-led or pixie-led, Claire, it seems to be leading us back to nature in a good way.
Yeah, yeah. I think it is, and that can only be good because we are nature, aren't we? That's I think we can quite easily forget that, you know, the days of smartphones and being able to order whatever you want at the click of a button, that this is where, you know, it's nature is our essential selves, really, that's where we're from. We're totally fallible. We're not.
Yeah.
We're going to go back to the earth. We came from the earth. We're going to go back to the earth. And we've only got this one planet to live on at the moment. Maybe in thousands of years' time, we'll be out in the rest of the universe. But yeah. And I just wanted to share also, there's another experience I had that where the little being, because I'm interested in the crossovers between all these different paranormal realms, so the ghosts and the UFOs, extraterrestrials. And I had one experience that I feel did make me feel like, okay, is there a crossover between fairies, and is one person's ET experience a fairy experience? I was on holiday a few years ago in North Devon and went for a walk along this beautiful valley that leads down to the coast. It's very remote. I was with my boyfriend of the time, and you follow basically this river valley to the coast and these cliffs, and then there's a beautiful waterfall. And we were looking up at this waterfall, and there was a little, what looked to both of us, because we both saw this at the same time, like a little figure sat up in the cliffs. And we both agreed that it looked like it was wearing a silver outfit. It was pale in colour, so sort of pale to whitey grey colour. Sat up high in the cliffs. Unfortunately, we only had our mobile phones, and as you know, you can only focus in so much.
Yeah.
And it was, so we couldn't focus in enough to really see this little figure in detail. My boyfriend of the time wasn't a believer in these things, but he honored, you know, he respected my beliefs. And he was gobsmacked. I remember the look on his face, because he said, "That looks like a little person." I said, "Yeah, I know." I mean, it was really strange. And it looked, the other thing it looked like it had was goggles on. It looked like it had dark goggles on.
Yeah.
That's another detail I remember. So there's two connections to this that I've recently found out. There are stories of fishermen going up and down the coast of Cornwall, seeing lights in the cliffs and hearing music, and saying that these were the fairy gardens.
Oh.
So it's a belief that the fairies, or the pixies rather, had their gardens along the cliff edges.
Ah.
So that's one thing from folklore from like 150 odd years ago. Then, like you, Paul, I like a rummage in like charity shops for secondhand books. And there's a fabulous bookshop in Newton Abbot where I live. And I, just the other day, I brought a book. I haven't got it in front of me, but anyway, it's called Weird Devon. And I was reading through just last night some of the accounts, and I was amazed because there's an account of a couple, this is back in the 80s, who are camping out in North Devon at a place called Stibbs Cross, which is only about 16 miles from where I had my sighting. So the boyfriend of this woman that was giving this account regularly saw this little being that he identified as a grey alien.
Oh.
And he called it George because he saw it so regularly and even was telepathically communicating with it. So it just made me think, could that have been what I was seeing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems to be an area of high strangeness, that part of Devon.
Yeah. Mm. I've often found it interesting as well. It's not so much happens these days, primarily because I think folklore has risen up to a level it's just squashing this old argument. Claire.
Yeah.
But a lot of skeptics would always say, well, people see the grey aliens now because they don't see fairies anymore.
Mm.
And that these days really makes me laugh because clearly people are seeing both things. Just because often in these particular cases, I think people don't look to see if anybody is seeing things, because obviously when I've spoken with people like Morgan Daimler and Joe and listened to some of the people that's been on your show, Claire, and also that have spoken with Joe and other people that are working in this field. I mean, the phenomenal work of, is it Simon Young?
Yes.
Especially we're talking about wonderful British stories. The Wollaton Gnomes in Nottingham has been a story that I've loved because I've visited Nottingham lots. And when you come from Sheffield to Nottingham, you go past Wollaton.
Yes.
All the way. Yeah. And even if I didn't, even if the route that we took didn't take us that way, I would always make people go that way. So I just wanted to be near to where it had happened, Claire, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted, because as you were saying about this creature wearing goggles, that was the thing about the gnomes that were sighted by this group of children, because the whole story's balmy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got a group of gnomes whizzing about in these brightly coloured cars, having a laugh, chasing this group of children. On a summer's evening.
I know.
And I've always loved it. It's one of those wonderful stories that really makes me laugh, but it also makes me think, why would a group of children from Nottingham create this fanciful story about bumping into gnomes? Because it's not like kids' telly in those days was full of things like gnomes. I think the only programme at that time that I remember having anything to do with gnomes or people sort of driving about, I don't know, people might say Noddy and Big Ears, were pixies and gnomes, but I don't think they were that popular by the end of the 70s, especially in Nottingham. It doesn't strike me as a hotbed of Enid Blyton fans, to be fair, in that day and age. There was a show called Chalton and the Wheelies. And there was one of the characters in that was a chap that used to drive about. But obviously everybody remembers the Welsh witch that lived in a kettle that Chalton would always foil in her evil plans to destroy Wheelie World.
I remember that, yes. Oh, gosh, I've forgotten about Wheelie World and, the witch in the kettle. That was so bizarre,
Kids' tellies in the 70s in Britain was a very weird place in general. If they weren't terrifying us by saying if we went near the river, the Grim Reaper would pull us in and kill us, Joe. Then we were watching surreal programs about witches living in kettles.
Just going back to Wollaton, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
Of course, the lovely Kate Ray has just released her book, Woolies Knots, which I have a signed copy of, which is fantastic. Which is her telling of the her fictional telling of the Wollaton Gnome story.
Fabulous. Yes, I've seen that flying about, and I know Kate's making some great waves in this particular field along with yourself and Joe. I think, is it Bethany Briggs? Briggs Miller down south. Does she do Erie Essex? I think
that's right.
Is a paid up member of the Team Haunted with Danny Robbins and all that. So I've seen her. Strangely enough, I was watching a paranormal program and she popped up on that the other week.
There you go. Yeah.
You fey pushers are getting everywhere these days.
I think the fairies are behind it. I think they want the promo, definitely.
Oh, good. Well, I'm all for it. I'm here for it. Well, Claire, it's been wonderful to speak with you. I think we've had a lovely and deeply illuminating and interesting conversation.
Yes.
Covering a variety of things. Where can everybody follow your podcast, keep up to date with your work, and what have you got planned next, Mana?
Okay, so you can follow my podcast on any platform that you listen to podcasts. It's called the Fairy Whispering Podcast, and I spell fairy the old-fashioned way with a A-E-R-Y. And I also have my website, the fairywhisperer.co.uk, spelt the same way, F-A-E-R-Y. I'm also on YouTube, the Fairy Whisperer, and some of my podcast episodes on there as well, some of the ones that I've videoed with people. So you can see, I often show guests' artwork and photos during the chat as well. So you can sort of see what we're talking about. Where else am I? I'm on Instagram, Fairy Whisperer. I'm on Twitter, at Fairy Whispering. And coming up, I'm doing a talk for Edgeways Group, which is a private Facebook group run by SJ Farrow. And it's a lovely group of people that came together during lockdown with mutual interest in the paranormal. And they have a talk every Saturday night. So I'm doing a talk for them on the 2nd of September called Creepy Cottage Call. And that's all about phantom cottages, which is something else we didn't have time to chat about this time, but maybe another time. And that's about cottages that people have come across in the Devonshire countryside and then gone back and they're not there. So you go back and it's either a ruin or just a pile of rubble.
Wow.
So I'm talking about that and some cottage hauntings and connections with the Fae. Also, what else am I doing? I've got series 2 of Fairy Whispering starting in September.
Excellent.
With lots of lovely guests. And the next episode of this series comes out 26th of July, and that's called The Goblin Market, where my guest talks about her experiences of seeing a goblin market on her windowsill. And I've also got a patron community. I have to mention them. It's just a small but very lovely little community of folk that support my efforts on the podcast. I feel very humbled to have people paying me to be part of, to support my work. So that's the Fairy Whisperer patron community.
Fabulous.
Well, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes for you, Claire, so people can track you down and catch up with your work and listen to your podcasts and your brilliant interviews. I will say there's a wonderful book called One Foot in the Green, which is by the wonderfully talented American artist called Brett Manning.
And yes.
If you don't own a copy, I would recommend it because it is sumptuous. It is one of the most beautiful books I've ever owned in my life. It's an incredible work of art. So if you haven't got a copy, I cannot recommend Brett's work highly enough.
Yes, I know of her work. Yeah, I saw an interview with her with Joe a few months ago. Yes, I need to order myself a copy because, yes, I'm a fellow artist admirer of her. She's amazing. Yeah.
Well, listen, Claire, it's been a real pleasure. Like you say, I will hold you to the ghost cottage conversation next time. Though I wouldn't say we've ignored it. We've dipped into it, but not too much. And I just want to say thank you so much for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. As I said, over the last 2 or 3 years, I've met lovely people, and it's a very it's almost like a nudge and a wink society that goes on that people say, oh, these people are all right, you're all right with these, and it's such a welcoming and embracing community, which I think for a lot of us who have had our fingers in this paranormal pie for a long time, it is refreshing to see how positive and supportive things are seeming to get, especially in this country. So long may it continue, and it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance, and I will speak to you again, Claire.
Thanks, Paul. I've really enjoyed talking with you. It's been wonderful. Thank you. Thank you.